Welcome everyone to All About Windows Phone Insight Podcast 222, recording this on 11th of July 2017. I'm Steve Litchfield. With me, the man himself, is back, Mr. Rafe Blanford.
Yes, hello everybody. That's a rather nice podcast number to come back to all the twos. And thank you to Steve as ever for, you know, doing the coverage and our guests that we've had in the last few weeks. We're getting one in with me because I think I'll be probably busy next week. But as always, we've got lots to kind of talk about, lots of opinions to share and some of the news and stuff to cover. And I suspect we'll slip back into some nostalgia as well as we talk about one of the pieces in this particular podcast.
Okay, and can I give you a quick pop quiz? What does 222, what's the common nickname for that in the cricket world? Do you know? Just testing.
I have no idea. I mean, I'd like to say it's something like a 2 plus a Desmond, but I don't think that's right.
Well, is it called a double Nelson? Because a Nelson is 111. This is the double.
Makes sense.
Just testing your cricket knowledge.
Every day.
There we are. Anyway, something else you learned today is that Windows Phone 8.1 has reached the official end of support from Microsoft. And this is really not a shock. Microsoft hasn't actually updated any Windows Phone 8.1 devices with patches or fixes. But I think, according to my calculations, going back in the news stories, Rafe, almost 2 years. So the fact they said, well, we're not going to patch it anymore, doesn't really come as any surprise to anyone. But the thing
the sky is falling. It's the end of the world. It's no longer... Hang on, wait a minute. Sorry, wrong podcast.
In Microsoft's post about this, they explicitly say they talk about the upgrade to Windows 10 Mobile. And the point I wanted to make is that an awful lot of people listening to this and an awful lot of Windows Phone 8.1 devices in general can actually be upgraded to Windows 10 Mobile. And at that point, they get an extra 2 years support, patches and fixes, depending on device. In some cases, it's 1 year, depending on whether they end up on the anniversary update or they end up on the creator's update. But once they get onto Windows 10 Mobile, they're on a completely different cycle. And as you well know, in the desktop world, Microsoft says, OK, well, every single branch of Windows 10 gets 2 years support from the day we launch it. So, for example, the anniversary update was, I think, August 2016. So that would be August 2018 for the end of support for that. Creators update, April 2017, that'll be April 2019. So some of these devices, Rafe, which came out in sort of 2013, 2014, as long as people actually, you know, go run through the upgrade advisor, which is still available, obviously, and do the upgrade to Windows 10, then basically they can go from end of support to another 2 years support. So I just don't think the sky is falling, as people say it is.
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, quite apart from that point of view, which I think is absolutely correct, I haven't really got much to add to that other than, you know, for people who want to, the update is available. It's interesting because some of the numbers that have come out about this, I mean, if you look at, I think it's the most recent Ad Duplex numbers, suggest that only around 20 to 25% of people are on Windows 10 Mobile out of the Windows Phone population. But you do have to consider that there are lots of people who won't upgrade their phone, are kind of using those older Windows Phone 8.1 devices almost as feature phones. And it was something that Windows, perhaps unfairly or perhaps quite rightly, actually got tarred with. But when you were able to pick up something like the, you know, the Lumia 520 or even the 435 for sort of 30, 40 quid in the UK and less in some markets, people were basically picking up as a touchscreen feature phone effectively. We remarked in the past that Windows Phone actually did that job pretty well. And of course, those people are going to have no interest in updating. And that made up quite a large volume of the active Windows Phone devices. So I think that can be a bit misleading. But I mean, I suppose it's significant as a milestone in that you kind of, this is the end of Windows Phone in the kind of the officially supported sense. But like you say, there is a route for people who want to go up. I mean, it's kind of ironic talking about this on a podcast named All About Windows Phone. We've talked in the past about kind of not changing the name because, you know, there's all kinds of usual web reasons about not wanting to change domain names. It's the name we're known by. And I suspect moving goalposts and all that sort of thing. And it's the content that matters, which Steve, of course, does a fantastic job on. But, you know, the other reason I'll talk about this kind of not being such a big deal is this is actually end of support in kind of Microsoft terms. And if you're a big corporate user, it might be important because you may have policies in place that say you can no longer use unsupported products. But for most people, for consumers, it's basically irrelevant. I mean, as you said, there are no more over-the-air software updates or security patches being delivered. So, you know, it's sort of an official support gone. Will you notice any difference? Absolutely not. And it's kind of interesting that Microsoft has basically supplied the model it does for its desktop and other software, and that it kind of says it's supported from, you know, a minimum of 2 years from the release date, which enables people to do some planning and have some certainty around it. But much beyond that, I mean, I find it difficult to think of any reason that a consumer would be dramatically be affected by this, you know, because it's not related to the hardware warranty, which will be separate. And in any case, for most people will no longer apply. I think the small case where it is interesting might be corporate users, and then they would be making a decision on that basis anyway about what they were going to do. And again, I suspect a lot of those are feature phones. I suppose the one thing is, it's a very small chance that some big kind of security hole could be discovered in these older devices and Microsoft would be under no obligation to patch it. But I think that's a very remote possibility. You're far more likely to have a serious security patch emerge on one of the kind of more popular platforms or the more recent platforms, just because that's the thing that, you know, people go after. And that would actually, in fact, I mean, and even if it's supported, there's no guarantee that gets fixed in a timely manner. I mean, we've seen that with recent ransomware attacks. And yes, there is obviously a problem with older devices. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to get out of that. But of course, it was an easy headline for people to write about. And, you know, yes, one more kind of nail in the Windows Phone coffin, but a very predictable one, since I think Microsoft has announced this date, you know, quite well ahead of time. It's been well known that this is coming. So I sort of find it tiresome just to read more stories about, you know, it's an easy jibe, if you will. And as you quite rightly point out, kind of the Windows world in terms of, I think, enthusiasts and people who like the platforms and like their devices will have moved on to Windows 10 Mobile, not least for, you know, app support and getting, you know, decent browser and all the other features you get. So, you know, not a non-story, because obviously it's worth a while reporting on it, but you describe it in the story quite rightly as a storm in a teacup.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to comment really on those ad duplex figures. And the way they do it is they take a certain number of games and applications whose developers have signed up with AdDuplex, and that then enables them to put in-app advertising, the idea that people, that the users then tap on the ads and they make some money, and AdDuplex uses all that ad tapping to generate these statistics. Now, only a certain number of games and apps actually use in-app advertising, and the ones that do, I would venture that almost every single person listening to this absolutely hates in-app advertising with a passion. And if you if you like an application or game and it's got the advertising, the very first thing you do is pay the 79p or whatever to turn the ads off, at which point you're not being counted at all in the statistics. So those statistics saying 70% of active Windows phones are on 8.1, that's 70% of the low-end phones of people who can't even be bothered to pay 79p to get rid of a few ads. In other words, we're talking probably teenagers and people, well, I guess people in maybe developing worlds, just to be kind, people who can't afford to pay for to get rid of the advertising. The vast majority of people who are really active in terms of Windows 10 Mobile, the Windows on phones scene, the vast majority are on Windows 10 Mobile and are not counted in any of these statistics. So that 70% on 8.1, I would venture, is probably more like 20-30%, and maybe the truth is somewhere in between, but they're certainly not telling the full story. They never have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. I think I would venture that you may be right about the kind of Windows on phones enthusiast market. I suspect you'd be surprised how few people do actually pay for the ad-free option, having talked to developers about it in the past. But I do agree that you're more likely to capture a certain segment when it's effectively ad-supported apps and games. And I would have thought that, you know, and we don't actually know, there's no transparency on the methodology in one sense. I mean, it's great that AdDuplex provide these figures, and credit to them for doing so and having done so every month for as long as I can remember. But yes, it's actually a sample of the Windows Phone population, and it's naturally going to be biased, because as far as I know, there are no adjustments made. I mean, if you think about things like opinion polls or general election forecasts, there's always weighting going on in those. And there is, as far as I know, no weighting in the methodology that AdDuplex uses, partly because it would be very difficult to do without doing a much wider kind of survey in general to kind of give that that best case or that weighting, some rigor in the methodology. But yeah, I agree, it's almost certainly biased towards people who are more likely to have those kind of free games. I mean, Apps Duplex is actually in a large number of apps. I think it's you know, well over 5,000 now. But yes, you're right to raise that. And I think if you talked about maybe the kind of engaged, active Windows on phone users, yes, I think the majority of those probably are on Windows 10 mobile. And of course, these figures are talked about earlier, those older phones, which kind of almost work as feature phones in some ways, with a few games maybe installed on them. And of course, Microsoft has sold less Windows 10 mobile devices, as have the other manufacturers. And so we're kind of almost back weighted. So, you know, the most recent devices, of course, they're running Windows 10 mobile, but they do just represent a smaller part of the population because the overall sales numbers have gone down. So it's a good point that's worth making, but I wouldn't get too hung up on it.
It's also worth mentioning that those really old devices, and I know they were popular, the 520 you mentioned, hugely popular back in the day, the 435, even the 630, they all sold very, very well. And, you know, Nokia going after the budget market and the teenage market, and they did pretty well, you know, relatively speaking, for a couple of years. But I wouldn't actually recommend any of those people with those handsets upgrade to Windows 10 Mobile. I think Microsoft made the right call there. There were some marginal devices, the 1020 being quite famous, and even then, I think, in hindsight, the number of times my 1020 has gone backwards and forwards to 8.1 because I wasn't happy with performance. On the whole, those are the people say, well, okay, the older devices are left high and dry because they can't upgrade to Windows 10 Mobile. But they would not be happy. Someone who's got a 520 or a 435 and is generally pretty happy as a sort of touchscreen, fairly fast responding feature phone with bells on. Yes, they may lose a few services. But if you then pushed Windows 10 Mobile to such low end hardware, the thing would just grind to a halt and they'd be very unhappy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a similar case, I guess, with some of the older Android devices as well. You get kind of a similar drop off on some of the services, probably more acute in the Windows world. And I, you know, I have to put my hand up and say, you know, I got very excited about the number of 520, 530 and all of those devices that were shipping at the time. And it actually enabled Microsoft and Nokia to effectively inflate. And it wasn't artificial because it was actually happening their shipment numbers and make things look, you know, very positive. And actually, both of them had a policy of going after these low-end devices. In one sense, it was what they needed to do to build the volume. But of course, you know, there's a different equation in one sense to what people expect off a £50 device and how long it will last and be supported versus, you know, one of the £500 devices. And actually, if you like, the older high-end devices where, you know, as your table shows, you know, it's possible to get them updated in some cases. The old devices, it was sort of deprovisioned, so it's not, you know, it's basically not so possible now. But the more recent ones, yes, you know, you can do it. And actually, those are the people that kind of feel justified in maybe having more of a grievance when, you know, things do drop off. And I'm thinking, you know, things like the 930 or the 1520, for example, are probably good examples of that. So, you know, yeah, it swings in roundabouts, but that's probably a good place to draw a line onto this subject. Otherwise, we could bore people to tears by talking about what ifs and hypotheticals.
Absolutely. Just to mention that though, that 930, of course, you can put it on the release preview ring.
That's true.
And to mention that my 930 got an update only today. There's a brand new build of Windows 10 Mobile for production and release preview rings. Ends in .483, 15063, .483. And it's running smoother than ever. My 930 has never run so well, Rafe, and I think there's a testament there. So it may not be officially supported on the creators update, but boy, is it running smoothly. Anyway, moving on, yes. Shock horror was my headline. I like to put a bit of clickbaity here every now and then. Windows 10 Mobile is far better for work than play. Who'd have thought it? Well, of course, we kind of knew this, but I wanted to just put some measurements and some screenshots and some real findings behind it, Rafe. Now, I'm guilty of something, I have to put my hand up, as are you, of usually having two SIMs on the go and having a Windows 10 mobile device, also having an iPhone or an Android phone on this just beside it. And the idea is that you use both and they both have their pros and cons. Both, some are good for one task, some are good for the other task. But of course, if you get to a task that Windows 10 mobile or Windows phone is rubbish for, you instinctively go to your iPhone or your, in my case, the Android phone device. And therefore, you never really live with the deficiency that you've discovered. So my idea was to go 24 4 hours on the road with just Windows 10 Mobile and no other tablets, no other phones, no laptops, no desktops, no cheating. And I wanted to document that. And I wanted to say that I got on really, really well with almost everything that was work-related and productivity-related, with one exception, that being Asana, which is a very much a niche thing. But in terms of email and productivity and web, even web browsing, almost everything was silky smooth on my Lumia 950 XL. Obviously, things like the photography, imaging, even video watching, and that, I guess, counts as entertainment. That was all silky smooth. But then when I started to do kind of fun stuff, and spare time stuff, maybe traveling around navigation, maybe doing social networking in certain cases, I started to hit barriers. And would you agree that I've kind of got the sense right that for work purposes and productivity purposes, Windows 10 Mobile is right up with the best of other mobile devices, maybe even ahead in some areas, but for the fun stuff, for the playtime, for the downtime, that's really where the platform suffers?
Yeah, no, I think that's a reasonable assessment. Whether it's sort of leading on productivity is probably open to debate, because Microsoft has done a good job of making its key productivity tools available on other platforms. I mean, I guess you could argue the benefit on Windows 10 Mobile is you kind of get them for free, whether to get the kind of the full versions or the full experience you're looking at an Office 365 subscription or similar elsewhere. But I would say in general, productivity is fairly even, other than to say that actually if you're within the Microsoft ecosystem, which a lot of people in the corporate environment will be, there is this real sense of familiarity if you're, you know, Windows through and through. And so, yeah, I probably would give it the nod there. And it largely depends on, you know, what you include in productivity and how far you go. So, you know, I mean, you talk about Slack in the example here, and yeah, that works fine. But then there are other tools that might be specific to your company, whether that's something like HipChat or one of the other kind of messaging services. And if that's not supported on Windows 10 Mobile, which to be frank is not unlikely given the kind of relatively poor level of support for third-party applications, there may well be a showstopper in there. And so that's the only caveat I would give, that there may be a showstopper. And you kind of mentioned it yourself with Asana. It's going to be those niche use cases. But, you know, looking at some of the core stuff, yeah, absolutely. And yes, on the personal level, there's just been a gradual degradation of what you're able to do. I mean, one of our commenters described Windows Phone 8.1 as kind of the heyday. I guess that's a reasonable way to put it, because that's when a lot more of the apps were available. The only thing I would say is actually, as you've talked about in your UWP reviews on the site and on the podcast, there's actually a lot of capability there if you're willing to go and look for it. It just doesn't have quite the slickness and the smoothness, or indeed, in many cases, the official app being available. And you kind of reflect then some of the screenshots and the comments in this feature editorial that you write about, you know, with the Snapchat example. And actually social is probably the one which I would say is the best example, because it's something that so many people want to do. I mean, we know that the likes of Facebook and Facebook Messenger are the most popular third-party apps on both iPhone and Android. And while they do exist, I would argue the performance and the quality is not the same on the Windows devices. And certainly once you get into edge cases, are a little bit unreasonable, but talking about some of the other things, you know, Snapchat or Prisma or whatever is your preferred current app of the week. We've talked about Spotify as well in a previous podcast, you know, plenty of examples where there are gaps, which is why, I mean, I guess it's fair to say both of us would say, yeah, we're absolutely using other devices as well. I mean, partly for work reasons, but I think if we're completely honest, we'd say, yeah, we'd probably be in that situation anyway, but we do like our gadgets. So we've probably been carrying multiple phones and using multiple platforms for years. For kind of the smartphone enthusiast or someone into their devices, it is basically getting difficult to say, oh, yes, you should get a Windows device. It's much easier to say, oh, get an Android or get an iPhone device. But in a lot of cases, actually, it's a corporate use case, or people already have one of the devices, or they just like to be different, and, you know, absolutely fine with that. But yes, I think you kind of get this right. So, you know, as a consumer, if you do this, and I think you found this in your kind of test case, that it can be quite frustrating. And actually, it's frustrating also because you can see how good it is in the business world. And actually, in the consumer world, there's not a lot Microsoft can do about it, because they're essentially dependent on third parties, which, you know, does reflect kind of Microsoft's decision to almost retreat from the world of consumers. I guess there was almost an inevitability about that as the numbers of shipments started to drop. I mean, while it's not cause and effect here, because actually they're closely linked together, but it does bring up this interesting question, of course, is, you know, would you recommend a Windows device to someone? And, you know, what then happens to the future of the platform when it becomes increasingly difficult to do that? You know, why would people have a Windows device, Steve?
I think it comes down to ecosystem. I mentioned this on my other podcast, and I know Microsoft do their apps now for iOS and Android. I know that Google do their apps for iOS and Android. Apple just do their apps for the iPhone. So things aren't quite equal. You could argue that because Microsoft do their apps for other platforms, why not go to the other platforms where you have the other apps? But I don't like mixing ecosystems unless I absolutely have to. If I'm on an iPhone, I like running Apple's applications. I don't want to run Google's or Microsoft's apps. If I'm on an Android phone, which I've got several Android phones here, I want to run Google's apps. I don't want to stuff it full of Microsoft or Microsoft apps. If I've got, if I want to use Microsoft's apps, Skype and Outlook, for example, OneNote. OneDrive, I want to be using them on a Windows device, and I want to be using exactly the same application, the same UWP app on my phone, my Surface Pro, my Windows 10 laptop. Basically, they can use the same interface, the same applications, the same data. I know you can do all this cross-platform pollination, Rafe, but I just think it's inelegant. I would like each manufacturer's operating system to correspond with the applications and the services. I just think that's neat. And if someone is actually embroiled in the Microsoft ecosystem, if they use Windows tablets, they use Surface Pros, they use Windows laptops, then actually, as long as they don't want to do all this fancy Snapchatting and hip chatting and stuff, then why not? Why not have a Windows 10 mobile device? If there was one to buy, which there isn't, which is a different rant for a different day.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would say is, I think the clarity of purpose that Microsoft has in particular around the PIM applications, and that's, I'm talking about calendar and email, and I guess tasks to an extent, although that's something I use less, I think is often better than that which you get on Android. I think iOS is maybe a different question, because there's a familiarity issue there, but particularly if you're a Windows user, kind of going onto a Windows device and having access to your calendar and your email and the kind of the actions that you associate it with, there's a stronger sense of cohesiveness between desktop Windows and mobile Windows, as there absolutely should be. And so I would argue that perhaps that clarity of purpose is something that comes up in the comments, and some people think there's a massive difference. I think that actually largely depends on your mail provider and how linked you are into Exchange and things like that. But it is a legitimate argument. Of course, the issue with that is there are so many other things that people want to do with the smartphone. So in answering my own question, I'd actually say it's about that Microsoft vision of continuity between the desktop and mobile, and when it does work, it's actually pretty compelling. And I think what a lot of people forget about smartphones, especially those of us who, you know, spend a lot of time playing with them or kind of are basically enthusiasts about smartphone and tech in general, there's a large proportion of the population out there who has kind of grown up with Windows, is very familiar with it, and kind of likes that sense of continuity and is less bothered by access to all the applications. Now, it's interesting because I think that market may be diminished in some ways because, you know, we're growing up with a generation that is used to having ready access to apps, and actually it's an app-first world for access to many services. It's not just the on-demand economy stuff like Uber. It's, you know, like your banking apps, for example, and there's increasingly an expectation for pretty much any service or brand that the primary way that people will communicate with it is through their app. But there are still, I would even suggest it's probably a majority of people, you know, if you think of friends and family, particularly those who are outside the kind of under 35 bracket, then there are a lot of people who just, you know, smartphones aren't quite as central to their life as you might think when you look at kind of the younger part of the market. And Steve, this is a case where you're young at heart and you're included in the younger part of the market. And I just have to continually remind myself of this. I mean, actually, in kind of the day job, it's always, you have to be cautious not to kind of go all in on kind of app only and app first, because actually, I think one of the biggest challenges that people designing digital services or being in charge of marketing and building things for big companies is that we face the next kind of 10, 20, maybe even 30 years where we're going to live with this hybrid situation with some people who are absolutely digital native and who grew up kind of PC first, and there's going to be the mobile first generation, and actually kind of coming next, especially if you listen to what Google and Apple have been saying, the AI first generation, where this idea of assistance that's always on will be, you know, completely normal. And you know, you can think about other interfaces like augmented reality, which may blow mobile out of the water in some ways, but there's still going to be a generation who are very much PC first and maybe desktop focused, and those who aren't as digitally savvy and, you know, just want traditional access to services. And that becomes an interesting thing in how you design apps, whether you provide an alternative to an app interface, you know, whether you do web and app and all those other things, and actually more challenges to come as more ways of interacting with technology come down the pipeline. And you know, I guess I've kind of got off the subject of why Windows, but it's just a reminder to me that you can't always think very narrowly from your own point of view about what people want from their phone. And, you know, I do still see people using Windows and sometimes ask them why they do it, and they just say, oh, it just works for me. And that's a healthy reminder to have. With all that said, that's kind of a bit of a cop-out, because, of course, the mobile world has moved on, and of course, you know, we live in an Android and iOS dominated world, but you know, it's, we still enjoy chatting about this every week on the podcast, but of course we've actually, I think in the last 18 months or so, taken a much broader view on how we talk about Windows and talk about mobile in general, which hopefully is means we've stayed entertaining and interesting, but you know, it reflects our background of where we've come from. But as Steve said, both of us are now using other devices as well, and probably our expectation would be everyone else would be in a very similar boat.
Yeah, but just coming to a few specifics from the article, I mean, Amazon Prime Video is something I do quite a lot of on other devices, and I have to, because you can't do it on Windows 10 Mobile. Amazon literally haven't written a DRM-equipped player for Windows 10 Mobile. You can kind of fudge it in a mobile browser, and people have said that that's possible, but I haven't managed to do it so far. Maps is interesting, because Windows 10 Maps is very capable, but it seems to have lost its live traffic routing, and I suspect this is just something broken at the server end after the creators update, and it's hundreds of people have voted it in Feedback Hub saying, bring back live traffic rerouting, so hopefully Microsoft will fix that. So that may be just be a temporary glitch. Going to Skype, I mentioned Skype was very slow to start there. Well, since I wrote that all 2 days ago, Microsoft has fixed it and released a new version, a new UWP client for Skype that said, not dramatically different, but certainly significantly overhauled. I know, Rafe, you're big on working iPhone and Android and other platforms, so you've probably seen the Skype reworking that has horrified people, where Skype has gone all Snapchat. Well, they've kind of gone halfway. They've centralized the interface and got rid of the hamburger menu, but they still made it very recognizably Skype. It's still dark themed, and I think it still runs very well on Windows 10 Mobile. But there is this new version, and that's all happened in the last day or so.
Yeah, and I actually had a chance to have a quick go. And yes, the performance seems to have improved. And as you say, it's maybe a more conservative interface than you'll see elsewhere. I mean, I've got so used to using different apps and switching between iPhone, Android and Windows that generally I'm not sure I don't care, because I do absolutely care. But as long as it remains reasonably usable, I probably don't get too fussy about the specifics. And actually, I think in general, Microsoft has done a pretty good job with Skype recently across all platforms about getting to the key stuff I care about, which is, you know, doing a quick message to someone or being able to pick up on a call. And I mean, I'm now using Skype for Business, which is Link, a lot. And actually the integration with Exchange, so you can kind of see upcoming conference calls and things like that, you know, is absolutely fantastic, saves an enormous amount of time. And actually those little bits of integration, and regardless of who's doing them, that actually you kind of pick up more, and so the usability becomes interesting in there. Actually, if anything, I think Skype on the three mobile platforms has got closer together more recently, and that's probably a good thing, because actually the familiarity of using it is there. Now, I guess the other Skype news we should mention, Steve, is that it's no longer working on Windows Phone 8.1.
Yes. Microsoft has been trailing this for seeming like years. I mean, it's not years. It isn't about 9 months or so, but they've gradually been saying, we're turning off the old peer-to-peer Skype mechanisms, and it's all going to be centralized. And the idea, obviously, is that peer-to-peer, you couldn't have many-to-many calls. So you couldn't have, say, five people on a video call. You couldn't have six people on an audio podcast, because the peer-to-peer thing would just break down, because it would all be funneled in through one person's internet connection. And in a world where they wanted to have many-to-many calling and video calls, the obvious thing to do was to have a centralized infrastructure and have high-capacity servers in each country, which acted as hubs for all the different calls going in and out. So I can completely understand why Microsoft bought Skype, they decided to do a complete re-architecture on it. And this is the final nail, really, in the coffin of the old architecture. And you'll find now, if you've got an older 8.1 device running Skype, it might still work for a while, but if you sign out, you would never be able to sign in again. So your time really is limited. And it's, if anything, that as long as you've got a reasonably recent device, sort of 2013, 2014 onwards, this really might be the push you need to do that upgrade to Windows 10 Mobile. Because I know some things about the phone will be slower, but you will get a lot of extra functionality. You get all the latest apps, you get latest security, and you get a working Skype client. Hallelujah.
Yeah, it's interesting this. I mean, I wonder how many people are impacted by this. I mean, and part of me goes, I'm a user, I don't care about what's on the back end and what Microsoft is doing. But I guess there is a time where you have to be reasonable. But there are going to be people who wonder why it's not working, will have no idea why, and won't have been educated by Steve as to why this has all happened. I mean, the thing that does interest me, actually, is that Skype is an example of a company that Microsoft bought, and I think a lot of people were a bit skeptical about what would happen. And yet it still, I think, has remained in a lot of ways the de facto thing for doing kind of international calling. And actually, if you look at the stats, a very substantial proportion of international calls go over Skype in one way or another. And actually, you know, obviously for video calls as well. I mean, it's since had a lot more competition over the years with the likes of FaceTime, but in many ways it proved the market for that kind of IP-based communication for telephony and for video calling, and actually still does an enormous number of minutes. Now, I can't remember the exact figures, but I know it's in the, it's billions of minutes per month. And, you know, it's interesting because we've, of course, seen other over-the-top messaging solutions arrive, and WhatsApp springs to mind, Facebook Messenger, you know, choose whatever your poison is. But Skype has remained quietly in the background, although in some ways it's never got into messaging in quite the same way as the others. I mean, it's always been a communication channel we've used on All About, and family and friends still watch channels there. But a lot of that kind of text-based stuff has switched to WhatsApp, and while I have used WhatsApp calling, actually still switch back to Skype some of the time for quality reasons, or because it just works, or it's what people expect. So it's just a reminder for me that actually this is an acquisition that Microsoft, in some ways, I don't want to say didn't ruin, but actually has managed to grow and evolve despite all the competition and all the other services that are coming competing with it. And in some ways, Microsoft has, it's a testament to what they've done over the years that it's continued to thrive. Has it been as successful as it might have been? Maybe not. But actually, I think it's one of those quiet things that it may not be as glamorous as WhatsApp or anything like that, but actually it's certainly kept tracking along. And for a lot of people, has been an absolutely vital communication lifeline. As I say, FaceTime would have taken over for a lot of people for that kind of family communication. But I still see Skype being used all the time. And actually, it's probably one of those ones that is, I'd almost say, agnostic across companies. Whenever you're doing kind of internal company stuff, you tend to use your internal company system, be that Link or Slack or something else. But when you kind of need to dial out to a third party, Skype actually still remains one of those great universal things that kind of works pretty much everywhere. Everyone knows how to use it. And, you know, it's like, oh, I'll call you on the phone, or I'll try and call you through WhatsApp. You go, oh, no, let's do it through Skype. Everyone knows that works. And actually, testament to what Microsoft's done, and they sort of deserve a certain amount of credit for that. It's almost become a boring utility, but that's actually not necessarily a bad thing. And so the fact that we've kind of got an up-to-date version now on Windows, albeit with kind of yet another kind of UI or UX treatment, the fact it's kind of disappeared from Windows Phone 8.1, I'm kind of sad about. As you say, I wonder whether that'll push anyone to upgrade the device. I don't think so, because I think anyone who was heavily reliant on it has probably long since moved on. It may be in the few hundreds, maybe not even that many. But yes, you know, this is a story I think we must have spent devoted more minutes to Skype and talking about compatibility and when it was going to stop being supported. It's lasted a lot longer than either of us expected. I mean, I think we said, you know, it was going to be a matter of weeks when this was announced kind of earlier in the year. It's been on the cards for a while. So hopefully it's not affecting anyone too badly. And actually, judging by the comments, that, you know, that's gone. And, you know, actually what I was just talking about, people switching to other things, is still there. But as I say, Skype, one of those hidden tools that perhaps doesn't get the credit it deserves.
Yeah, of course, I think they had to extend the life of Skype on 8.1 because of this, waiting to the end of life of Windows Phone 8.1 itself. I think the idea was to tie the two together, and so that people couldn't really complain about Skype not working because the whole platform was, you know, end of support. I think that kind of made sense. They delayed it for that reason. It's also worth mentioning, I still think Microsoft's strategy with Skype is more coherent than any of the other platforms. I mean, Apple is what you're kind of locked in. You've got iMessage and you've got... a FaceTime, so you've got two different products handling the two different functionality. Google has got about three different versions of SMS messaging, plus Hangouts, plus Allo, plus Duo. So all of this, these different applications, Microsoft has just Skype. Skype does chat, Skype does voice, Skype does video. So it's all many-to-many. So in a sense, the Skype is a far more coherent, more elegant, more efficient system, and it does deserve to do better. And it's doing okay, it's carrying on, but I think it deserves to succeed. I do wish Microsoft well with their redesign. If they can make Skype more trendy on iPhone and Android, then good for them. Maybe that will be a kick in the backside for Skype. Yeah. Generally,
I mean, it seems unlikely, and obviously its strength is on PCs, and it's easy to sort of dismiss it as a niche player on mobile, but it is one of the more popular applications. You only need to look at the download numbers in the Google Play Store and the rank in the App Store to see that. And it is true that others have come along and kind of offered the same functionality. You know, WhatsApp does voice calls, that kind of video calls being integrated into Slack and every other over-the-top messenger. But sometimes those can be a bit flaky and unreliable. And I think in some ways, the fact that it becomes, you know, the great fallback, as I've kind of described it earlier, is kind of interesting to me. But it's also interesting, whenever you talk to people about it, it elicits greatly kind of ranging reactions. It's kind of like the Marmite of these voice calling tools. Some people absolutely love it and swear by it, and some people have moved on and shifted to other things. I guess that is a reflection of its kind of desktop legacy, and that's where it's still strongest. It'll be interesting to look at some numbers and see what the profile of people using it. I would imagine it kind of does flew to an older generation and more, you know, desktop-based people. But it's interesting. We've used it to record the podcast over many years and still use it personally for kind of doing the international calls, and particularly in the business context, and occasionally personally as well. We also, I use it when talking to my 361 podcast colleagues for setting things up. And as I say, it's kind of just that universal go-to because it just works. So reflected in the comments on your article, some people are fans of it, some people aren't. But yeah, I guess it's not going to be closing the chapter on us talking about it on Windows devices, but certainly the chapter is closed on Windows 8.1 Skype.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to mention, just in terms of the retrospective and why things were the way they were, when Skype started, of course, which I'm guessing is somewhere around 2006, 2007, this is just off the top of my head. But of course, bandwidth was much less plentiful then. Then if you could get a one-to-one voice call going, you were doing pretty well over the internet. And that was what Skype's purpose. It was one-to-one. And it wasn't really until sort of, I guess, 2009, 2010, when people started wanting to do many-to-many calling. At that point, it became a problem. And that's why things had to change. But just to go back, the reason Skype did it that way in the first place was because it was a world of different connectivity. As we've said, looking back in the world of Symbian and Nokia back into the early 2000s, it was an operating system, it was an idea, everything was based around the bandwidth constraints of the time, and they were severe constraints by today's standards. And I think sometimes people in 2016, 2017 don't quite appreciate how byte-starved we were 10 years ago, Rafe.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Steve. I mean, the constraints of the kind of the smartphone era have kind of been crumbling away. And Skype was just an example of that. But yes, look back 10 years and things were very different.
Yeah, and talking of looking back 10 years, I did a retrospective. We'll just finish on this story, Rafe, because I know you may have something to say. 10 years of iPhone. Now, I know this is all about Windows Phone, but we were all about Symbian before. And back in the day, 10 years ago, Symbian was utterly dominant in the smartphone world, 60% market share. And what I rail against, Rafe, is I listen to other commentators and articles and on podcasts, and they talk about before iPhone and after iPhone, and talk about the innovation that the iPhone has brought to the modern world. And yes, I completely agree. And in my article, I covered the things the iPhone did bring, and it popularized capacitive touchscreens. It popularized having a all-screen interface that could adapt as needed and not have to rely on physical controls. Absolutely. But apart from those two things, just about everything else in terms of what makes a modern smartphone was actually done first by other companies, and quite often by LG, by Sony Ericsson, and of course by Nokia. And in the article, I kind of go over some of the things, particularly the N95 could do. That was just a breakthrough device, really. I know Nokia, it was quite expensive. It's still, I think it was over £500 when it came out. Goodness me. And it looks quite tiny and tiddly, even compared to the original iPhone. But the sheer functionality in terms of imaging, in terms of multimedia, in terms of connectivity, in terms of, yes, third-party apps, including hooking it up with accessory, the sheer number of things the N95 could do blew the iPhone away for years. It wasn't really until the iPhone got to about the iPhone 4S, I'd argue, that the Apple smartphone really became a modern smartphone and could actually compete with what Nokia were doing. So I just wanted to set the record straight with this piece, Rafe. The iPhone brought some wonderful things to the modern smartphone world. I do agree, but let's not forget the contributions of all the other companies, but among them our beloved Nokia, and especially that N95, released in almost the same, just before, in fact, it was about 6 months before the iPhone original.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is right. There's always a tendency to simplify history down, and it's very convenient putting down markers of before and after. And you're right to say that the iPhone was incredibly significant, and I actually agree. I think it's the popularization of the capacitive screen, although, as you say in the article, they weren't even the first to do that. But it's the power of marketing it's the oft-repeated observation that Apple often wasn't doing anything particularly innovative, but it was wrapping it up and providing an experience that was superior. I mean, I agree with you, actually. The first few versions of the iPhone weren't as superiors, I think people would have you believe now, and even some of the commentators at the time. But it did get a couple of things crucially right, and actually capacitive screen was part of that, but actually it was what that enabled, which was finger touch, which again had sort of been done before, but prior to that the kind of touch world, particularly on smartphones but in PDAs more generally, had been stylus driven. And you know, Steve Jobs has obviously a well-known observation that if it's got a stylus, you're doing something wrong. I think that's actually, for me, the most powerful thing about the iPhone in terms of, you know, the precedent that it set. And that's what changed the thing. And if you want to do a before and after, it's not about smartphones. It's about that introduction of touch in a way that became mass market and very powerful. There is all the other things that wrapped up into the iPhone. And I think apps in particular, you have to sort of say they made much easier in terms of discovery and distribution. And that's reflected in the app economy that's been born subsequently. But certainly, you know, all the ideas were there before. And we've talked before about Nokia having an app store in the form of download. It just wasn't executed quite right. And it's, in one sense, yeah. A big tragedy of Nokia was pretty much everything you look at, they already had tried or talked about, but hadn't executed quite right. And I don't think you should underestimate the genius in actually wrapping things up and providing an experience that second to none, and then the ability to communicate to people about it and tell people how it works and educate them about it. And that's what Apple did fantastically well with some of its marketing and some of the communication around it. I mean, the device I always am reminded of whenever I think about this is the Nokia 7110, and before that, so the 7000 series, which was running series 90, which was kind of the Hilden UI, which was massively ahead of its time. If you do some Googling, you'll find some articles by all sorts of people talking about this, but actually it's scary looking at that, just how much of that is in the modern smartphone and kind of the ideas we kind of take for granted now. Obviously they have evolved and things have moved on as we've got better performance, and actually finger touch is maybe one of the big things that wasn't quite there, but that was more because of the technology wasn't quite there, the fundamentals or foundations weren't there. But pretty much everything else, you know, and so we talk about the progress that's in the last 10 years. But of course, the thing is, if you are looking forward 10 years and trying to understand what technologies are going to be important, they've actually been around for 10 years before. I mean, that's the so-called long nose of innovation by Buxton. That's one of the theories that gets talked about. And actually, you can see that happening now, because actually things like AR and artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of those things have been around, and only in the next 10 years are they probably going to have an enormous impact. And the same was true of mobile back then. So yes, it's kind of frustrating to see that the iPhone is talked about as the source of all these innovations. I mean, at the time, I can remember the browser being held up as this amazing thing. And actually, WebKit had been on the Series 60 devices for quite a while at that point in time. Even the use of something like the accelerometer, kind of the sensor to detect the orientation, that had been around and actually had been come out of the Nokia research labs. But it was something that was kind of associated with the iPhone. Maybe they just made better use of it. And I do think some of the kind of simplicity on the platform, particularly later on once we got to kind of iOS 5, 6 and beyond, you know, there's a lot to be said for that as well. But yes, you look at the kind of functionality, and if anything, some of those older devices were in some ways superior to what we have now. And things like VoIP, for example, on the Nokia device, on the Symbian device, were incredibly sophisticated at the time. It's taken a long time for kind of Android and iOS to catch up. And in fact, they're still in some ways not done in quite that open framework. And obviously, other things have come along which have kind of changed the landscape there as well. But even, you know, thinking about cameras and things like that, it's absolutely right to identify the iPhone as a convenient boundary stone. But I think you have to, when you're writing that kind of history, acknowledge that there was a bit before that. Otherwise, you're kind of indulging in revisionist history. Calling the iPhone the first smartphone is a complete misnomer. And, you know, it annoys me because I guess it lacks the detail and the precision that when you talk about things, I like to be able to see and talk about. You know, of course, when we talk about this, we're going to probably be slightly skeptical because running all about Symbian knew all about that. And actually, that is rapidly fading into history. And, you know, for a certain number of people, they'll be absolutely familiar with it. They'll understand the history and they'll understand the point. But it's probably worth saying that it is now history. So it's probably not worth getting too wound up about.
Yeah, I love the Blandford capacity for understatement. You were talking about the download store, the on-device app store in the early Nokias, 2004, 2005, a full 3 years before Apple introduced it for the iPhone 3G in 2008. But that the original download store, it wasn't just, quote, wasn't executed quite right. It was appalling. Let's face it, it was almost empty and utterly appalling. And I told them so at the time. And they seemed to have no enthusiasm whatsoever of making it any bigger. They said, oh, no, people only want 20 applications. We're very happy with the partners in the store. We don't want to add them, which is, and if you think of where the concept of apps and app stores went over the next 5 years, is utterly ridiculous. So yes, it was absolutely true that the Nokia S60 handsets had an app store in 2005, 2006, but it was pretty rubbish. So credit to Apple for that, you know, popularizing that concept and doing it properly.
Yeah, I mean, you could also talk about Ovi Services and actually the acquisition of Gate 5 for Nokia Maps and various other companies, all of which kind of have disappeared without trace. But that idea, that sense that services were going to be important on smartphones, Nokia clearly foresaw. And in some ways, the Maps applications were way ahead of time. They were also the ones who innovated giving it away for free. It's hard to remember that now. But actually, it was a big deal when Nokia announced that, you know, navigation was going to be completely free. Previously, you'd have had to buy a TomTom type device or spent, you know, anything up to £100 buying kind of the mapping license. So the fact that that was given away for free, you know, that's actually set expectations right across the smartphone landscape. And you can go even further back. I mean, I remember being at one of the very early Nokia, I think it was a Nokia Internet Conference or Nokia Multimedia and Internet Conference, and they talked about a service that would download video content onto your phone overnight so you could then watch it on demand. And the reason it had to do it overnight is because it was happening over a slow connection. And they actually thought this would be a good thing for operators because it would actually encourage the network to be used during quiet times. But actually that idea that you would be watching video on your smartphone and that you'd have this concept of kind of on-demand content rather than broadcast, and because there was things like the DVB-H devices, the N92, Thank you, Steve. So even they're kind of pioneering around that kind of content watching and multimedia was absolutely there. And, you know, you go back further and you kind of the idea of uploading photos automatically, and Shosu and Nokia had their own versions as well. You know, all of that stuff was there. It may not have had all the richness in the tapestry of apps, which we associate with a massive app economy and the app landscape, but a lot of it was there. And actually, you know, the amount of genuine innovation, I guess in the last 10 years, it's been there, but it's for me, a lot of it's been about evolution. And I guess if you've watched the smartphone industry very carefully, you kind of get this sense that it's this continuing story. And actually, it's been about going from a few million people using smartphones to a few billion people using smartphones. That, for me, is the big change in the last 10 years. And that's had all sorts of knock-on effects in terms of the economies of scale that it's been able to achieve, the pricing that's come down, you know, the fact you can have companies now that are entirely based around just having an app as their core service. You know, it's kind of hard to think back 10 years or even longer than that and imagine companies like Deliveroo or Uber or any of the on-demand companies that are so based around this idea that everyone has a smartphone. And for me, that's the innovation. That's the amazing thing that's happened. And in the next 10 years, actually, we're going to see things like machine learning, artificial intelligence come in, and the augmented reality. We're starting to see signs of that from both Google and Apple, and obviously Microsoft also with HoloLens. And so it does feel like, I've said it quite a few times over the last few years, that I do actually think there's kind of a bit of a momentum shift that's going to happen. And actually, I think the signal for it will be Apple and Google and perhaps Facebook kind of producing consumer AR devices. And those, because of their nature of them, are going to be very heavily dependent on kind of AI and kind of alternative interfaces to think about how it presents information, how it does that, how it overlays it on the real world. And that will be a step change. But for the last 10 years, and I would actually argue it's the last 15 years, going back to the first Symbian devices, which kind of started to introduce the idea of the smartphone or the mobile device as a platform that was extensible, that could have things built on top of it rather than it just being purely a voice and text device. That, to me, has been the revolution. And the iPhone, that 10 years, sits bang in the middle of that. And yes, it's absolutely the story of the massive popularization of it. But I think when people look back in another 10 years, it will still be acknowledged as very important. But actually, probably more credit will go towards Android, which has actually done more to democratize smartphones and put it in the hands of billions of people. And I expect that trend, honestly, to continue. And I think people will look back and see Symbian as the kind of foundational piece of smartphones, that kind of concept of the platform of the computer in your pocket. And there will be stuff going back before that with the PDAs and the Palm Pilot, or going right back to the IBM Simon. But actually, there was that shift. And then iPhone, as I say, kind of conceptualized the experience, particularly around finger touch and the fact that it needed to be packaged in a way that was attractive to the mass market. And whether that's the App Store or the laser focus on hardware design and user experience, which, to be fair, is, you know, spread throughout the rest of the kind of smartphone industry. And then, as I say, the last part of that chapter will be Android taking it to the mass market, taking it to billions. So the question is, of course, what comes next? And I guess that's what we'll talk about on a future podcast.
Indeed. Although I do notice, Rafe, that I think you're on holiday next week, a well-deserved holiday. And we should encourage people to think that we haven't forgotten them. If there isn't a podcast one particular week, I'm going to try and get a few more guests on. But we are into the summer holidays here in the UK now, so things may get slightly erratic. But we have given you basically an hour in this half-hour podcast. We've given you double length for value for money. So with that, I think we will draw it to a close. Thank you ever so much for listening. All about windowsphone.com, of course. Thank you for all your comments and all the stories. I do try and read them all, and I respond to a few of them, hopefully not too argumentatively. In the meantime, I'll say goodbye and I'll let Rafe do the sign off.
Yeah, it's a goodbye from me as well. Thank you as ever for Steve for all his hard work, and thank you to everyone for listening, and please tune in next time.